Since March 2007, one online audio production group has pushed the boundaries.
Broken Sea Audio Productions presents Maudlin.
It's Sounding Board. Audio drama with Lumpy Bits.
You have been listening to Jake Sanson.
Broken Sea Audio Productions presents
My name is Feedback, and these are my stories.
Last time on Gaia's Voyages.
This is the Broken Sea Audio production of Escape from New York.
OTR Swag Cast.
Doctor Who. Starring Mark Kalita as the Doctor. BrokenSea.com. New audio every Thursday.
Journey to a faraway land, where swords and sorcery decide the fate of kingdoms. Travel the paths of warriors and wizards as they fulfill a forgotten prophecy, culminating in a furious battle between the forces of darkness and light. The adventures begin in a humble tavern filled with tall tales and dark secrets. Sit thee down and hearken to the saga of the Grog and Griffin. Only Broken Sea Audio, in conjunction with Westlake Films, where fantasy audio is forged.
Face me in!
And now, it's time for the Broken Sea Audio Production OTR Swag Cast.
Welcome back to the Swagcast. We're back with another episode of Zero Hour, starring George Kennedy and the host, yes, Rod Serling. Also, we'll have a couple of Avengers episodes and, of course, Flash Gordon, because in January, Swagcast is going to take a holiday until February, so I'm going to try to squeeze a lot of stuff in. And Boris Karloff and the Grinch. Hope you enjoy. Merry Christmas from Broken Sea Audio.
Book of yellow, blue, and red. Now I I'm Rod Serling. You're listening to the Zero Hour. Rest your eyes. Exercise your imagination. This week, Charles Larson's inside story of television murder. Someone's death. Starring George Kennedy, Joyce Boulafont, and Robert Reed. In Elliot Lewis's production of The Zero Hour. The medium of television has become very much a part of our lives. Good, bad, or indifferent, television exists. When it's bad, one has only to turn it off. Unfortunately, the same cannot be said for murder. Once committed, the act lingers on, as do the consequences. Nils Frederik Blixen produces television programs. Joanna Redfern is his casting director. Dan Gladstone was her boyfriend, an ex-boyfriend who met extinction when shot through the head by an unknown assailant. The police are casting young Joanna as the murderer. Nils Frederik prefers to disagree, and he's screening a large cast of character types to fill the role. Nils Frederik Blixen. He thought he knew it all.
I overslept. Got in my office about 10:30. It was all in the paper. The murder, Joanna working on the series. At least they got my name wrong. They called me R.G. Blixman. The phone had been ringing all morning. My boss, Arthur Todd, among others. My secretary is a real brain. The trade papers, the scandal sheets, she told them all the same thing. I was out. So as not to make her a liar, I left the executive building, passed along a row of darkened projection rooms, climbed some narrow wooden stairs to a frosted glass door marked Research. There I found old man Tibbet. He'd been in charge of this department since it opened. When he referred to the big war, he meant number one.
Ah, hey. Yeah, Mr. Nils Frederik Blixen in person. How's the new series coming?
Walter, I've got a tough job for you.
Yeah?
I want to know what magazine these words were cut out of. Can you do it?
In other words, you're thinking of using this threat letter in a script? Oh, they won't let you use language like this on TV.
No, just something I'm working on. What I want you to do is find what magazines these words were cut out of. Could you do it if I gave you a general area, like comic books?
Well, I could try. Who do I charge my time to if it's not a TV episode?
To me. On the way back to my office, I stopped in at the executive washroom, which bears a slight resemblance to the Taj Mahal, and ran into my star, Murph Smith, combing his hair in front of one of the mirrors, a broken-nosed, slope-shouldered man in his late 30s.
This murder, Nils Frederik. I called Mr. Todd at 3 this morning and asked him to get rid of the Redfern girl. He promised he would. I always thought she was a little gummed up.
Did you?
Well, you know, hanging around with all those blacks. Hey, by the way, why do I have to be Jewish in this series?
I didn't know things like that bothered you, Murph. You want things separate but equal, right?
Right.
Did Acadia Playhouse work that way, too, when you were there? I met a friend of yours last night, Bobby something. He lives with Rene Ortiz.
Oh, Bobby. Yes, he went to Acadia.
So did Dan Gladstone, and he was murdered.
I've got it. We never mention I'm Jewish. I play a Jewish inside. And my secretary, Raquel, we play her blonde. A lot of Mexicans are, you know. You buy that?
No. Is that clear enough? No.
Oh, come on. I haven't demanded much.
You haven't deserved much. You'll play it the way it's written. Is that clear? The way it's written.
Come on. It's a gag. You're the producer. What the heck do I know? Okay?
When I got to the studio in the morning, the Chavez test was underway. I didn't have to see it. The reports came to my office from those in the know. Cameramen, grips, all the guys on the set who'd seen him come and go. She was sensational, was all they said. Finally, I decided to go down and take a look for myself. When I reached the door of the stage, there was Preston Andrade. We were both stopped from entering by a blinking red light.
Hey, pal, how are you?
You started working here now?
No. Remember you invited us? And what do you know? A friend of mine is in there testing for your series.
You know Isabel Chavez?
Do I know her? Boom Boom's inside. We all know each other.
Then you and Isabel are friends?
Oh, for years. Since my wife died in 1960.
Isn't Boom Boom jealous?
Jealous? She hates her, even though I'm old enough to be Isabel's grandfather. It's like with you and Red. It's just Boom Boom likes to come to a set. Want some coffee from the machine? I could use some.
No, thanks. Incidentally, have the police been around questioning you and Boom Boom and the others?
I'm not worried. I got an alibi. I was in Tijuana on business. I heard there was some good cashmere down there.
I suppose everybody else was home.
Well, Bobby and Renee were home. Boom Boom was at a preview. Phil, I'm not sure.
About Boom Boom's husband?
Fred? No, I think he had a lodge meeting. You know, that kid Phil works too hard. All day at the drugstore, then practices, eats, and falls into bed.
Where does he sleep?
In my room, back of the flat.
Then you'd know if he ever tried to sneak out.
Well, I don't think he does, which is more than I can say for our little neighbor.
Which little neighbor?
Heidi. She sneaks out nights.
Do you know that for sure?
As sure as I've seen her crawl out her bathroom window.
You've seen her?
Many times. She has to pass my room.
Where does she go?
Who knows? But I know what she'd say if I asked her where she was going.
What's that?
Out.
I spent just long enough on stage 16 to verify that Red's actress find, Isabel Chavez, was indeed the new Carajurado. On the way to the office, I ran the usual gamut of disaster. My production manager beefing about the number of setups, my associate producer bringing me network static about credits, and then the front office informed me I'd lost my first choice director and would have to beat the bushes at this late date for a replacement. If that wasn't enough, I found my secretary in tears.
Oh, Mr. Blixen, I hate to bring my personal problems to the office. It's nothing. I mean, it's something, but it just can't be helped. Let's not talk about it.
Let's.
Well, it's my father. My mother called this morning from Chicago, and he's 72, and they just found out he's got cancer.
I'm sorry, ma'am. Would you like to go there?
I just can't waltz off and leave you. Not in the beginning of the season. Maybe later. We'll see. They're going to keep me notified, and if I have to go, I'll go later. Oh, so now I've added another little straw to your back. Let's see. Mr. Schreiber called. He said it was important. Shall I get him back?
Yes, please. I'll take it inside. Yes, Wade.
Nils? Look, I've had another conversation with my friend at the North Hollywood station. Apparently, Joanna lied to them about something. All he'd say was she told a whopper they checked up on it, and she's in big trouble. Now, he expects Sergeant Ames to go to the DA within the next 10 days.
If it's about the car, she told you she borrowed Renee's car that night, didn't
she? Yeah, she told me that, and I told the police it's not that. They've checked Renee's tires, and they don't match the tracks they found.
I didn't know that they'd found any tracks.
Oh, yeah, a couple of pretty good ones. Fairly well-worn firestones.
Then what else could it be?
Well, unfortunately, she's the only suspect who seems to have had both motive and no real alibi to speak of.
What about Gladstone's clientele? Surely Ames knows by now he was a pusher.
No, Gladstone was very small potatoes, just starting out. His supplier's in Tijuana, but informers haven't turned up a thing.
Wade, you still have a couple of private operatives on the payroll?
Yeah. Listen, if you got an angle, tell me.
Preston Andrade. He said he was in Tijuana the night of the murder buying cashmere. Now, there's nothing easier to check out.
So, what's your point?
I don't know. I'm fishing. But people have a tendency to project their own attitudes. Maybe Andrade's the jealous, possessive one.
You saying that Boom Boom and Dan Gladstone were playing around?
Why not?
Well, Nils, she's old enough to
what's age got to do with it? To hear you people talk, you'd think that everybody went off into a cocoon or something at the age of...
Nils,
Nils, look, I'm sorry, all right? I'll write it down. Preston Andrade, Tijuana, jealous, okay? Anything else?
Oh, Andrade's wife died in 1960. I want to know how.
Wife, how?
And as long as we're reconfirming alibis, find out if Renee and Bobby were really both home on the night of the murder. Motive, jealousy again.
Renee, Bobby, both home. Okay, go on.
Phil?
The kid isn't a suspect.
He uses downers. More than occasionally. Question who supplied him. Suppose he wanted out, and his source wouldn't leave him alone. And I'd also like to know why he left Hollywood High.
Phil, Holly High. Okay.
I don't know if Heidi can drive a car.
Nils, is there anybody you don't suspect?
Certainly. Red. Monday morning, this series went before the cameras with more problems than I care to recount. And my neck stuck out to hear for having signed Isabel Chavez. Not to mention my star, Murph Smith's charming acceptance of his leading lady.
I am not going to work with that fat-headed Joel. No way ever. I want that human fright way out of my series. I'm the star. I'm getting out.
He was an overpaid employee of NFB Productions, and he'd honor his commitment or answer in court, and that's what I told him. We were only a half a day behind schedule at the end of the first day's shooting, and I was badly in need of a drink. Mary was not in the office. She was probably down in the ladies' room. She'd been doing a lot of crying lately. So I had to look for the whiskey myself. I found it where she'd filed it, under W. And I was walking into my office in search of a glass. Wade Schreiber was stretched out on my couch, his arm over his face. I made that two glasses. Might as well give me the bad news. I can read it all over you.
Well, if there's one rule a lawyer's trained to live by, it's never get personally involved with a client.
Red's in trouble.
Nothing a miracle wouldn't cure.
Well, if you're going to tell me, tell me.
All right, Nils. Brace yourself. You know the .22 that was used to kill Gladstone?
They found it?
Not yet. But they found out where it was purchased. And a gun dealer says he sold it to a young woman.
Let me guess. The woman was a redhead.
There'll probably be a warrant out for Red by tonight.
Warrant? For murder?
You betcha. Murder one.
Wade Schreiber straight-lined the information. A clerk in a pawn shop in Fraser, a little town in the Imperial Valley, remembered his boss selling a .22 to a young lady from Los Angeles on the 5th or the 6th of May. That was the weekend Joanna and Gladstone had had their big fight. The 6th was also the Sunday, Joanna had told the police, when she just got into her car and drove and drove through the Imperial Valley.
Yeah, if the guy can identify Joanna's picture, they'll have her.
They won't have anything except a girl who bought a gun in a moment of fear and panic, probably to defend herself with.
Yeah, that's what I like about you, Nils, an unbiased opinion.
Have you told Joanna?
I would if I could find her, but I can't. I think she's run out.
Well, the police know where she is. She's their chief suspect. They must have a tail on her.
Your TV detective would have a tail on. A real policeman can't afford those luxuries.
Well, she's got to be around. Maybe she went to the beach.
What, in this weather? Come on, Nils.
Doesn't Boom Boom know where she is?
No, and no sign of Boom Boom either. No sign of anybody. Except Ellis' granddaughter.
Heidi? Andrade tells me that Heidi's been sneaking out of the house at night. Heidi hates Red with a blind passion. Red reminds her of her mother.
Suggesting what? That she's trying to get even for the dirty trick her mother pulled on her? Nils, this is a child we're talking about.
Children hate and sometimes kill. Where would you expect to see the word paramour in print?
Well, I don't know. Victorian novel?
And this word was cut out from a magazine. Cheap ink, semi-pulp stock, some letters in color, some hand-lettered. Who are today's Victorians? Today's adolescents. And what do adolescents read? Comic books.
There were comic books piled to the ceiling in that garage, but anybody in the fourplex could have gotten to them. And you can't be absolutely positive the words were cut out of those comic books.
Well, I'm working on it. As I entered the soundstage, they had just wrapped up the day's shooting. My star had retreated in peak to his dressing room. Isabel Chavez was slumped in a canvas chair with her name lettered on it.
He's a real thinker, isn't he?
He's a talented child who expected us to cast a starlet he could dominate, not an actress that he'd have to compete with.
Oh, for the life of a movie star, the glamour, the excitement, the aching behind.
You're doing great.
Oh, one thing, Isabel, before you go.
Yes?
I just heard about a deal on 4 new tires. I can't use them. Wondered if you or maybe Andrade...
Not me. I'm in good shape, and Andrade just bought some.
Oh, really? When?
Well, 2 weeks, I think.
I don't suppose you'd remember what they were.
Sure, the same as he turned in the Firestones. Hasta luego, Patron.
It had begun to rain. Ellis was coming toward me across the lot. He was drunk, weaving drunk, as though he'd been wandering, not sure of where he was. He kept widening his eyes in an effort to focus. We stopped under an overhang.
Hey, how are you? Mary said you wanted to see me.
Red's in trouble, Leonard. She's going to be arrested.
I need a drink.
You're going to choke eventually on that poison.
Oh, what's the difference? Who'd even notice I was gone?
Heidi. Come on, Leonard. Let's go back to the office.
Heidi doesn't give a ticker damn about anybody but herself. Her mother's daughter. A bad seed. I know. Question is, where did her mother get it? Not from my side of the family. Never was a murder on the other side till her.
Doesn't matter what your priest thinks, my friend. Suicide is not murder.
Who told you about my daughter?
Matter of fact, Red did.
She tell you she killed herself?
She said that Florence and her husband were a double suicide.
Yeah. Florence shot her husband in the head after dinner one night and then stuck the gun in her own mouth and pulled the trigger. I bet they were June 3rd. She would have been 38 years old yesterday. Now you know why the old sot started drinking last night and kept it up and up and up. I'm hard. All right. Don't worry.
The rain had increased. It fell straight down in steely sheets, roaring onto the pavement. I raced up the slippery steps, on into the building and into my office. Ellis right behind me.
Oh, wait, he's just coming in.
Mary seemed suddenly flustered. She was on the phone, jiggling it to get her party back. Jack was there, waiting to drive me home.
Hi, Mr. Blixton. Hey, can you believe this rain?
Jack. Mary, was that Red on the phone?
No, it was Heidi for her grandfather, but she's hung up. Leonard, she wants to know if you're coming home.
Mary, give me your file key. Come on.
The bottle's empty. I threw it out.
Mary, I want the key.
The bar's closed, Leonard. I went into my office and dialed Red immediately. No answer. I put the phone back in its cradle, vaguely conscious of the conversation from my outer office. Mary was on the phone talking to Heidi, something about whether or not Ellis would be coming home for dinner.
Heidi, your grandfather says you go ahead, fix yourself a TV dinner, and then he'll eat when he gets there.
I saw him lunge for the phone, but the connection had already been broken.
Why did you let me talk to her?
Leonard, you're too drunk. Now sober up before you go out. Here, have some black coffee.
Mary was right. He was drunk. I offered to take him in the cab, but he just walked on ahead of us when Jack and I came out of the office. I told Jack to take me to Red's apartment. The only thing I could hope for was that I'd find her there. I wasn't in the mood for conversation.
Hey, I made one up for her. A haiku for Miss Redfern. You want to hear it? Listen to this. Snowman on the hill, melting in the springtime sun. That's me when you smile.
That's nice, Jack.
Nice? You kidding? That's lousy.
No. Not at all. Not lousy at all. I know exactly what you mean. Exactly. And I did. Exactly. Snowman on the hill, melting in the springtime sun. That's me when you smile. There was no smile when we got to Red's place. There were police cars, flares, and barricades.
More units? Any units in the area to 16,000 to Long Bridge?
see the woman of family that
appeared. A cop in the street was waving for us to drive on. I told Jack to go back to the corner and wait for me. Then I changed my mind when I realized that all of the excitement was at Ellis' apartment. There was no way to make out a voucher in the downpour, so I dug out a $5 bill, paid Jack, and sent him away. Sergeant Ames?
Oh, Blixen.
Where's Miss Redfern?
In custody. She's been booked for this murder, too.
This murder? In 2 minutes, I had the story. Detectives Ames and Griswold had been second and third to see the body. Red was first. They found her standing over it. Heidi Ellis was dead. Murdered. And Heidi's blood was all over Red's hands.
Tomorrow at this time, rest your eyes and listen here to this week's continuing study in suspense, Someone's Death. I'm Rod Serling, and this is The Zero Hour.
Today's episode brought to you in part by Ford Motor Company and Metropolitan Life Insurance Company. This is The Zero Hour on Mutual Radio.
Been listening to The Zero Hour, a presentation of the Mutual Broadcasting System in association with Hollywood Radio Theater, heard every weekday at this time. Rod Serling is your host. Zero Hour is produced and directed by Elliot Lewis. The Hollywood Radio Theater theme was played by Ferranti and Teicher and is now available on United Artists Records and Tapes. Hugh Douglas speaking.
Now, from the makers of Coldwater Irma.
Yeah, the window's the third one from the top, isn't it, Bruce?
That's right.
Okay, here it goes.
The man called Maskin grabbed his window cleaning gear and began to climb the ladder he'd propped against the red-bricked wall of the ministry. Just a window cleaner at work. No one gave him a second glance. A short while after that, John Steed's telephone rang.
John Steed?
Mr. Steve Peters here from the ministry.
Oh, yes, please.
There's photographs that Mrs. Beale dropped in. I've got them on the projector and... just a moment. There's someone at the...
Hello? Hello, Peters. Peters, what is it? What's happened?
Trouble, Steed.
Sounds like it.
It sounds like big trouble, Mother. In fact, it sounds like murder.
The Avengers. John Steed and Emma Peel, The Avengers.
Episode 3 of this story, in which John Steed and Emma Peel look into the window cleaning business in the odd case of the super secret sucker snatch. John Steed and Emma Peel were investigating the murder of Arthur Jarrett, a top ministry security agent of MI-12. Jarrett had disappeared while checking on the security at the British Cypher headquarters. Steed had called at the headquarters and been puzzled to find that all the staff denied ever seeing Jarrett. Mrs. Peel, checking with Ferret, a forensic expert, had discovered Jarrett's body in the window seat of his own apartment. Later, from the evidence of Jarrett's miniature camera, it was clear that he had visited the Cypher headquarters. Mrs. Peel had passed over some photographs to Peters, the photographic expert at the ministry, and it was while Peters was making a phone call to Steed to report on his findings that Steed heard a shot ring out. He didn't need any urging from Mother to get over to the ministry at top speed, collecting Mrs. Peel on the way.
This way, Mrs. Peel.
Wow, what a shambles. The whole place is wrecked.
Yeah, someone made sure of this, all right.
They made sure of Peters, too. Up there on the floor. Still all right.
Hmm. Shot through the window.
Yes, looks like it. Glass over everywhere. The projector he was using has been smashed to pieces.
Yeah. Look at this. A tray containing charred ashes. Ashes of the photographs I gave him. So they were important.
Must have been. Got in by the window, having shot Peters just as he was making his report to me.
Hmm. He got in by climbing this ladder. It's still here.
Foresight. Not every assassin who carries his own ladder.
In broad daylight, too.
They seem to get away with quite a few things in broad daylight.
Especially murder. Sheer audacity.
Right. Pity Peters didn't have time to tell us what he'd found.
Well, at least we're on the right track.
And we've still got the negatives.
Then we can make more prints.
Precisely. Would you care to join me in my dark room, Mrs. Peel?
You think it's safe?
Oh, I shouldn't think so. You've seen my etchings before, anyway. Why not my bromide papers?
Well, as long as they aren't too overexposed. Shall we go?
Mrs. Peel climbed nimbly through the window, and gripping the ladder with the inside of her feet, slid swiftly down to the pavement.
No end to that woman's talents.
In Steve's apartment, Mother was sampling a dry sherry and talking to George Webster of Cypher HQ on the telephone.
Yes, George, old boy, I'm afraid it is serious. Jarrett is dead.
Terribly sorry to hear that, Mother, but really it's hardly our responsibility. We didn't know him, you know.
That's not what MI-12 say.
To the devil with them. They're always wishing things onto others. Dunplace is a law unto itself. They lose a man or two and think it's got to be someone else's fault and not their own carelessness. I repeat, we've all got our own jobs.
It's the security angle that worries them. Your place supplies all the codes of the country. Anyone penetrating your security gets information on all other departments.
We know that. That's why our security is so good. Can't be broken.
And if I told you I had photographs taken in your own office only yesterday?
I'd say you were stark raving mad.
Hmm. A bit bitter.
What's that? Of course I'd be bitter.
I'm talking of my sherry. All right, George, old boy, if you're sure you're right, and of course I have to take your word for it.
I know I am, Mother. But thanks for the call. If I can help in any way, let me know. Bye.
Bye. One of us is a blithering idiot, and it's not me. And this is a most inferior sherry. I shall have to go home to get a decent drink.
These prints seem about right, Steve. I'll just fix them and then you can turn the light on.
Right. Let's take a keen look.
Let them off. Leave them to dry naturally. There we are.
Magnifying glass. Nary a clue in sight. There has to be one somewhere.
Steve, this one, the exterior of the courtyard, right outside the Cypher headquarters. Look, there in the corner, a van with ladders on the roof. Ladders, Steed.
Clever girl. I think I can just make out the lettering on the side of the van.
Mm-hmm.
Classy glass cleaners.
Window cleaners? Again?
Ladders.
In broad daylight? You expecting a visitor?
Oh, not that I know of. Mother will see to it.
But Mother, in his wheelchair, merely raised his voice and said,
"Come in."
Ah, the formidable ferret from forensics. Come in and close the door. I'm allergic to drafts and rodents.
Hello, Mother. Steed and Mrs. Peel here.
In there.
Mother indicated the kitchen with a gesture of his glass.
Cooking up something, or rather, something is developing in there.
What?
I hate to think. You're on duty, of course, ferret?
Yes. Yes, I suppose I am.
Too bad. I know how strict your department is about drinking.
I don't
think you should either.
Oh, hello there, Ferret. What's new?
Ferret is on duty and not drinking. That's new. I presume, Ferret, that your department is now in a state of complete panic.
Yeah, pretty nearly. First Jarrett and now Peters.
Quite. Status quo, complete panic. What are you planning to do about it? Turn to us once again?
The fact is, we thought we should put someone else into Cypher headquarters.
Put someone else in?
I see.
They seem to have been all prepared to deal with Jarrett.
Webster denies it, of course. I think his mind is going, getting too old. Pity used to play quite a good rubber of bridge in his day. Introduce who went to Cypher headquarters, Ferret?
This time it would have to be clandestine. Of course, there's someone from outside our department who's completely trustworthy.
Ah, then it would have to be someone outside, of course.
Yes, someone who could move in smoothly without creating undue attention. Yeah, of course, the position will qualify for the 5 shillings a day danger allowance.
Who could refuse that?
Who exactly do they have in mind?
You, Mrs. Peel, to start tomorrow.
Me? But I...
That is, of course, if Mother allows it.
Oh, but of course, of course. Mustn't forget that extra 5 shillings a day, eh, Steed?
Well, it's hard to refuse.
Yes. Only one condition, Mrs. Peel.
And that is?
You use your extra income to buy Steed some decent sherry.
Well, I'm all for that. I have none left, I know.
And just what will you be doing, Steed, while I'm at Cypher HQ?
Me? Oh, well, if it's a fine day tomorrow, I think I may have my windows cleaned. That's an idea, isn't it?
It was a fine day, and John Steed looked up the address of Classy Glass Cleaning in the telephone book and called upon their premises.
Good morning, sir. Good morning. Lather is the name. Charles Lather.
John Steed, I'm looking for a window cleaner.
Oh, well, then look no further. At Classy Glass, the world is our window. Just observe our thoroughness, sir. Look at our trainee.
Lather motioned to 3 young men who were practicing on ladders, cleaning away like fury at huge panes of glass.
Anti-clockwise, James. Now, anti-clockwise. Always anti-clockwise. Apprentices, sir, they will try the easy way, you know.
Oh, can't be too careful.
Exactly. There are no shortcuts to the tops of our ladders. Here we really care about windows.
I'm delighted to hear it.
Oh, beautiful, Wilson. Beautiful. Lovely touch with the lever. Just a shade more wrist action. There's a good lad. We only use the finest camel skins, you know, Mr. Steed.
Camel skins?
They hold twice as much water.
Oh, of course. Yes.
Now, we offer 3 services. Wash and dry, cream shampoo with a hot air finish, and our deluxe spirit treatment with a full leather glazing and crystal clear finish.
Nothing but the best.
Splendid. A high book for you for our deluxe. And now, approximately... Howard! I have told you before, Howard, the bucket in your left hand, held loosely but firmly at right angles to your hip. The hip, boy. Now, all together, that's better. There you go. I'm so sorry, Mr. Steed. Approximately how many millimeters will you require treatment?
Approximately one.
One?
The family seat. I had the rest of them boarded up.
Boarded up? Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Steed. We have a duty to our employees. The sight of all those boarded windows, well, we've had men crack under this.
Oh, it is a pity. I'm only just round the corner from one of your regular clients, the Cypher Headquarters and Ministry of Defense.
Cypher Headquarters? Oh, right, I don't recall. Ah, yes, I remember now. Of course, double glazed with molded frames. Ghastly. But we haven't touched it for months. We used to have the contract that we gave it up. Uneconomical. Besides, all that grey, that's quite so strong.
Oh, I see.
If you ever decide to reopen your windows...
Well, you'll be the first to know. Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Steed. Now, boys, left hand from the hip, please. From the hip.
Steed left and got into his car. As he pulled away, a small van came from the back of the building and followed him. Watch that driving mirror, Steed. Watch it.
Avengers. Listen every evening, Monday to Friday, to John Steed and Emma Peel, The Avengers, brought to you by the makers of Cold Water Omo.
presenting the amazing interplanetary adventures of Flash Gordon. Last week, Flash Gordon and Dr. Zarkov were attacked by Tall and Grum at the head of a band of rebellious magic men. But the rebels' plans were upset when Flash threw one of his paralyzing gas globes, and Grum was killed, but the others escaped. Dale Arden discovered that Azura, the wicked witch queen, had been rescued by the magic men. Then Dale went to warn Flash and Zarkov that Azura had been set free. She arrived at the apartment occupied by Flash and got in just as Saul and his officers returned with a dissolvable ray gun to lay siege to it. Flash, Dale, and Zarkov thought the enemy had withdrawn and were about to open the door and make a dash for their hawkmen when they were amazed to find the big metal door was melting from the dissolvable gun rays. Rather than face capture by Saul and the blue magic men, Flash and Dale and Zarkov decided to make the dangerous attempt to escape through the window and down a steep cliff. These thrilling adventures come to you as they are pictured each Sunday in the big full-page Comic Weekly, the world's greatest pictorial supplement of humor and adventure. The full-page Comic Weekly, each page printed in full colors, is distributed everywhere as an integral part of your Hearst Sunday newspaper. And now we continue the story. With one strong arm holding Dale close to him, the other gripping the stout vine, Flash slowly and carefully gets a foothold in the twisted tendrils and works his way down to the ground. Above him, Dr. Zarkov, keeping watch for the pursuers, lowers himself with one hand, a ray pistol clutched in the other.
Hang on to me, Dale. That's it. Don't be afraid.
I'm not, Flash, darling. I know I'm safe when I'm with you.
Confidence gives me assurance, my darling. Zarkov?
Yes, Flash?
Any signs of them yet?
Not yet. They evidently haven't discovered our departure.
Oh, I hope they don't until we've safely reached the ground.
So do I. More than that, I hope our strength holds out that long. If it doesn't, we fall.
Don't think about it, sweetheart. We shall die together if that happens.
My darling, it won't happen while I have a breath left in my body. Control of these two arms. Come, Zarkov. Let's hurry.
Meanwhile, back in the palace, Saul urges his men to speed the melting of the apartment door.
Hurry, men, hurry. Get that door melted through. You and you, stand ready with your sleep gas rifles. The moment the door melts through, let them have the gas.
Yes, General Saul.
Right, General Saul.
Well, well, what's delaying you? Why isn't that door melted through? Isn't that dissolvo ray gun working properly?
Yes, General.
Well,
the gun is working all right, but that's a specially constructed door. It's very thick.
Thickness shouldn't make any difference to a dissolvo ray. Concentrate the rays on one spot.
Yes, General. At once. There. See that red glow appearing?
Yes.
That's where the rays are being centered.
Good. That's more like it. Now we shall get results. Why haven't they opened the door before this? They must see it melting.
They may have barricaded themselves in another room, General.
You may be right. That is foolish. The dissolvo rays will go through the other doors like nothing at all.
We've cut through the door, General.
Shoot some gas through the hole. Quickly. Now, reach through and unbar the door, and we'll go in.
Nobody in here, General.
Try all the rooms.
Empty. Not here. Not here either.
They've escaped, General Tom.
How?
Through that window.
Through the window?
Look, by means of this vine. The leaves are torn off. As far down as we can see.
Now, cut the vine. Cut the vine and let them fall.
But that's impossible, General. The vine is so fastened to the cliff that cutting it here wouldn't cause it to fall and take the ex-prisoners with it.
Oh, curses. They've escaped, but not for long. Call out the guard.
Hold guard.
Arouse the troops and set after them.
Troop order.
We'll let them have their long climb and meet them at the bottom.
As I dare with safety.
What's the matter, Dr. Zarkov?
They discovered we're gone.
Who? Oh.
I see light flash at the top of the cliff.
Oh, what's going to happen to us?
Nothing, darling, nothing. We're almost at the bottom of the cliff now.
But suppose they cut the vine.
It won't do them any good, Dale.
Why not?
It's too deeply rooted into the side of the cliff to make any difference.
Thank heaven. Are you all right, Flash?
I'm all right, Dale.
I can climb down the rest of the way, I think.
Just hang on to me. We'll make it all right. Zarkov?
Yes, lad?
Look down there. What do you suppose that light is? Campfire?
I hardly think they would have guards posted along here. It looks like a hut or hoistman's cottage.
I hope you're right. We're desperately in need of shelter.
How much farther, lad?
I think we could drop to the ground from here.
Then hang on to the vine. There, have you got it?
Yes.
I'll jump first.
Are you all right, Flash?
Yes, jump. I'll catch
you there. Here I come.
I have you safe in my arms.
Jump, Zarkov, coming.
Well, lad, we escaped from the palace.
Yes,
but we're not safe yet. As soon as they find us gone, they'll send out searching patrols.
Flash, there is a hut or herdsman's cottage over yonder. I just saw a door open, and there's a man standing in it against the light from inside.
You're right there, yes. Come, Zarkov. We'll ask shelter from yonder peasant. Hello! You in the cottage there.
Hello.
Can you give us room for the night? We've lost our way.
Who are you?
What difference does that make? We're tired and hungry and have lost our way.
Well, I can't help that. My hut is small. There's only one bed.
You're a strong man like ourselves. Give up your bed to this girl. The three of us can stretch out on the floor.
No. I don't know who you are. You might murder me in my sleep.
Why should we bother to murder you? If we were murderers, we wouldn't pick a humble herdsman for a victim.
Oh, you're wasting time and words. You aren't coming into my cottage. I never let strangers in at night. Be on your way, or I'll send you away with my sword.
Well, lad, I guess there is nothing else to do but start walking.
Is that so? We haven't finished with this fellow yet.
Come away, Flash. He may kill you.
He's bluffing. Friends, we simply must have a hideout from the sharp eyes of Azura's scout patrols. You know what will happen if that devil Tal catches us?
Oh, yes. Tal mustn't catch us.
Tal? Azura? You are fugitives from the palace?
Yes. Will you give us shelter now?
I will not. I don't want to be mixed up with you. I've never had trouble with the people of the palace, and I'm not going to start now.
Oh, yes, you are. Defend yourself.
Lad, be careful.
You will, you will.
Come on. Good
work, lad. You got him.
Quickly, Zarkov. Help me drag him into the hut. Inside with you, Dale. Hurry. Come on.
Yeah. Oh, Flash, you could have ruled the Blue Magic Land if it hadn't been for me. I got you into all this mess.
Dale, darling, I'd rather have you than six kingdoms.
Listen. We got here just in time. There goes a patrol of magic men searching for us.
I knew there wasn't any time to be lost. Well, we're safe here for a while.
But when they start searching the cottages and hovels around here, we won't be.
That's true, Dale. We are in danger of discovery at any time.
Escape from this wild land is impossible. And we can't hope to conquer Azura without help. What will we do?
Oh, if I could only finish my newest invention.
What is it, Zarkov?
A machine for bending and destroying light so that... but what's the use of thinking about it? We have no materials here and no way to get them.
There is a way to get them.
How?
Are you dreaming, lad?
No. Give me a list of what you need. I'll raid one of Azura's signal stations.
Flash, with a list of the required machinery and scientific apparatus, mounts the peasant's horse and sets out on his perilous mission. At the signal station, he gets the supplies. At dawn, after a night which has been sleepless for Zarkov and Dale Arden, Flash returns, and the two men start to construct the light machine. In the meantime, back in the palace of Azura...
Well, have you found them?
No, General. They've disappeared, leaving no trace.
They raid one of Azura's signal stations, take most of it away, and disappear, leaving no trace. Bah!
But the patrols are still searching, General.
Searching where? In their beds? In their stables?
No. All the roadways, General.
Roadways? You suppose the ex-prisoners are greater fools than they are? You think they will be sitting by the side of some roadway, waiting for our patrols to pick them up? Search every house in the kingdom. They must be hiding somewhere.
Yes, General.
Heart, listen. Who is that?
The other ex-prisoner. The one who was guarding Queen Azura.
Get back to the door.
Yes, General. At once.
You are my prisoner. Take me to where you have hidden Azura.
Guard, arrest this man.
Put your hands up. Drop that sword. So, trapped. But not for long. You forget Flash Gordon is king here. You'll suffer when he hears of this.
Perhaps. But no one knows how long it will be before he hears of it.
And why not? What do you mean? Well, what are you smiling at?
Oh, didn't you know? Your friends have left the palace quite hurriedly. By a window.
Left the palace? Mm. Impossible. Why should they?
Rather than face the flames of a DeSalvo gun, which was melting the door of their apartment, they chose flight. How unfortunate they didn't wait for you.
They went away without me?
Yes.
Well, what are you going to do with me?
They searched for the guard, Queen Azura, didn't they?
Yes.
You were searching for her when you walked in here. Am I right?
Yes.
Since you have been so closely allied with the person of our queen, I shall see to it that you still are.
You will?
But this time, you will be her slave instead of her guard.
What?
Unfortunately, she hasn't yet recovered from the effects of the lithium drug. Do you understand?
Yes, I understand, Carl.
Well, is that all you have to say?
No. Thank you for the opportunity to serve Queen Azura.
After 2 days and nights of feverish work, Flash and Zarkov assembled the light machine.
Put this electrode over there, lad. I'll set up this one.
What a maze of dynamos and wires and tubes. What is it supposed to do, Dr. Zarkov?
You will see. As soon as we get it assembled, you will see what it will do.
Do you think it will work here?
It should work, unless we have made some mistake in putting it together. Flash, help me adjust this dynamo.
That they are a master of suspense, Zarkov.
Here we've been working on this thing for 2 days and nights, and Dale and I don't know any more about it than we did when you first mentioned building it.
Well, is it not the best way? If you do not know what it's supposed to do, then you won't be so disappointed if it does not work. The dynamo is all right.
When are you going to try the whole machine, Dr. Zarkov?
Just as soon as we get it hooked up, Dale. Flash, help me set up this platform.
I'm dying of curiosity. What is this thing for, anyway?
Be patient, my child. Be patient. This is the machine which will help us conquer Azura.
Is it some sort of long-distance ray machine?
I don't think it can be, Flash. Don't you remember what Dr. Zarkov said about it being able to bend and destroy light?
That is right, Dale. You have a good memory. That's what I said.
Oh, yes, yes. Now I remember. But that's all you said, Dr. Zarkov. The machine is finished now. Can't you tell us about it?
I shall do better than that. I shall show you what it does. Flash,
yes.
Please stand on that platform.
Here?
That's right. Now, Dale, watch Flash. Keep your eyes on him, if you can.
Why, he's disappearing.
Yes.
Only his shadow remains. Flash, are you all right?
Well, of course, I'm perfectly all right, Dale.
You see, Flash is invisible. No one can fight what they cannot see. So Flash will become the avenging shadow.
Will Flash Gordon, made invisible by Dr. Zarkov's latest invention, conquer the blue magic land as the avenging shadow? And don't forget our date at the same time next week for the next chapter in the amazing interplanetary adventures of Flash Gordon.
Now, from the makers of Coldwater Omo,
John Steed, following the vaguest of clues, had called at the offices of Classy Glass Cleaning. A gentleman who called himself Charles Lather was in charge of a training session involving three apprentices.
Anti-clockwise, boys, anti-clockwise!
Oh, I'm so sorry, Mr. Steed, but your assignment really does sound too small. Only one window, and all the others boarded up. Well, I ask you.
Oh, it's a pity. I'm only just round the corner from one of your regular clients, the Cypher Headquarters, Ministry of Defense.
Cypher Headquarters? Ah, yes, I remember now. A double glazed with molded frames. Ghastly. But we haven't touched it for months. We gave up the contract. Uneconomical. But if you ever decide to reopen your windows, Mr. Steed,
you shall be the first to know.
Thank you. Good morning. Good morning, Mr. Steed.
Now, boys, left hands from the hip. From the hip, please.
Steed left and got into his car. He started it up and pulled away from the building. As he did so, an open van with ladders slung across the back came from the rear of the courtyard. Steed took off down the road. The van followed him.
The Avengers. Thank you. John Steed and Emma Peel, The Avengers.
Episode 4 of this story, in which John Steed is made to realize that window cleaners can be very dangerous, and Emma Peel almost sees another murder committed in the Super Secret Cipher Snatch. The department of MI-12 was in a rare panic. They'd lost two men, Jarrett and Peters. Ferret, who was in charge of forensics and very actively involved, had appealed to Mother. Mother had agreed to help, but apart from making a few phone calls and drinking most of John Steed's sherry, he hadn't got very far. He'd put Steed and Mrs. Peel on the case, and they'd followed through on evidence from some photographs of Jarrett's. Peters had been killed by a man posing as a window cleaner. There was a window cleaning van in one of the photographs, hence Steed's visit to Classy Glass Cleaning. It had been amusing, but not very helpful. At least, that's what Steve was thinking as he drove away.
Jarrett got into the Cipher HQ. Everyone denies that he did. But he did because he took the photographs, and we know the date from the calendar on the desk. Now, an attempt was made to destroy the photographs, which shows they must be important. The only clue on the photograph of the window cleaning van... Well, perhaps it was just coincidence. More than coincidence.
But in the open van, following at a discreet distance, Maskin and Bickers had other ideas.
Yeah, still got him up ahead.
Yeah, he won't get away. We'll pull up nearer to him once we get out in the country. Dad is all ready?
Four of them, two across the roof, one sticking out the back. One I can use over the side.
Right, let's see what we can do then.
John Steed was taking his time, driving thoughtfully and leisurely. He hardly noticed the open van until it was almost on him, hogging the road.
Well, pass if you want to pass.
Steve gestured irritably to the van to pass. The road was narrow. The van approached and swerved. A steel ladder in the body of the van swung out as though by accident. It missed Steve's car by inches.
All the crazy lunatics. Steel ladders. Did I say it might be coincidence? That's a lot.
Now, from the back of the van, Vickers, using another longer steel ladder, swung it from side to side, reaching out for Steve's windscreen. Steve braked, swerved, and pulled off the road. The van disappeared round the bend in the road. Steve muttered an oath under his breath that condemned all window cleaners to perdition, and started the car again, determined to get to grips, this time on his own terms. And there was no question about not being able to catch them up. The small van couldn't get away, but the road was narrow and twisty. Steed, using all his racing knowledge, soon made progress, and then, coming round a sharp bend, there, stretched across steel trestles, were four ladders, their ends pointed like lances. It was like a tank trap, and Steve drove straight into it. Mrs. Peel, for her part, had agreed to help out in the latest plan of MI-12, which was to place in Cipher headquarters a fresh agent. Someone who could move in without creating too much attention and keep an eye on things from the inside. Mrs. Peel had been chosen for the task. The danger money was an extra 5 shillings a day. And Mrs. Peel was not impressed.
You're allowed to smoke, if you wish.
Thank you. No, I won't. But please, go ahead.
I don't seem to have a light. I wonder...
Excuse me. Yes, Mr. Webster?
Will you come in, please, Mrs. Peel, and bring your book with you?
Yes, sir. Excuse me, Mr. Murray.
Yes. Good morning.
Please take a seat.
Thank you.
You have been checked through security, I take it. All your papers are in order.
Mr. Murray has been most thorough. There's no need for the department to go any further checking. I have a triple star clearance.
Is this Mother's doing?
Pardon?
Mother. Oh, come, Mrs. Peel. This is Cypher headquarters. We are used to unraveling complicated puzzles. You surely don't think a man like myself is going to accept an outside appointment like yours without checking. Mother has planted you on me, hasn't he?
No. Ferret of MI-12, actually.
I wish they'd get on with their work and leave us to deal with ours. All right, I'll accept the fact that they have trouble and they're trying everything. All right, I won't complain, providing you do your job like everyone else.
I have all the qualifications, Mr. Webster. I might be able to do you a bit of good. I promise I won't do any harm.
Right. Well, having cleared that away, perhaps you'd be good enough to get me Q-file. You'll have to present my signature to Murray. It's top secret. Here. Bring it straight back in here, please. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Webster.
With that, Mrs. Peel left the boss's office and found Murray, who was still looking for a light for a cigarette.
Mr. Webster wants Q cipher file. Here's his signed authorization.
Right. This is the most important part of the whole cipher system. It's automatic, of course. Works on the right combination of buttons.
Mrs. Peel took out the correct file and was about to ask Murray to close the machine when she looked out of the window. There, down in the courtyard, was a small van, classy glass cleaners clearly marked on the side. Mrs. Peel frowned, paused. Two men got out of the van and moved to the back, removing a series of steel ladders from the roof.
Come along now, the file.
Hmm? Oh, yes, sorry.
And Mrs. Peel moved swiftly over to her desk and picked up a telephone.
Outside line, please. Thank you.
What about that light? Darned if I can find one.
Hmm? Oh, there's some matches in my handbag. Just a moment. Here you are.
Oh, thanks.
Mrs. Peel listened intently to the phone ringing at the other end. There was no reply. No reply because the number she was ringing was John Steed's car telephone and John Steed was lying beneath it, hardly conscious. Steed picked himself up from the floor of the wrecked car. The car phone had stopped ringing. Steed looked around him. His bowler had been torn by the steel ladder that was jutting through the broken windscreen. Steve picked it up shakily and patted the metal casing. Then he reached to the phone and dialed operator.
Hello? Hello, operator. Could you get me Lessington? Cypher HQ, please. It's very urgent.
Sorry, sir. All the lines are engaged.
Well, then use the security line, please. 010.
Hello, caller. I'm afraid the security line's out of order.
I see. Thank you.
Steve thought for a moment and then rang another number. In Mother's apartment, the phone shrilled.
Mother speaking.
Mother? Steed. Look, how quickly could you get someone round to Cypher headquarters?
Well, I suppose I could get one of those dreary people from MI-12. Ferret himself, perhaps.
Good. Then send him off there straight away.
Right. But what is all this about, Steed? Where are you and what's happened?
I can't explain. There really isn't time. But I think someone should get over there at top speed in case Mrs. Peel needs some help. I can't get there quickly enough myself. I'm down in the country and rather tied up with a ladder at the moment.
A ladder?
Yes, and I've a nasty feeling that the other parts of it are about to be used down at the Cypher HQ. Oh, don't waste any time, Mother. This is an emergency. Bye.
But look here, Steed. I... Really?
Ferret?
Mother, job for you, Ferret. Write down your own rabbit warren, too. Get over to Cypher HQ, find Mrs. Peel, and don't walk under any ladders on the way. That's an order.
Ferret knew Mother in this mood. He didn't argue. He moved. Arriving at the headquarters, he was staggered to find not a soul in the courtyard.
No one here. No guards on duty. No one. What the devil?
The passageways were silent and empty. Ferret, in near panic now, ran the length of the corridor and burst into the office that had been given to Mrs. Peel. She stood by the desk, her hand still on the telephone in its cradle, her eyes stared sightlessly.
Mrs. Peel? Mrs. Peel, are you all right? Mrs. Peel?
Mrs. Peel didn't move or acknowledge his presence in the room.
Mrs. Peel, what happened?
A wet window cleaner's leather dropped over Ferret's face. He struggled for air, but the leather tightened into a shiny brown mask, tighter and tighter, suffocating him. He stopped struggling eventually and sagged to the floor, dead. Mrs. Peel stood still, frozen, expressionless, looking down at the body.
The Avengers. Listen every evening, Monday to Friday, to John Steed and Emma Peel, The Avengers, brought to you by the makers of Cold Water Omo.
Every who down in Whoville liked Christmas a lot, but the Grinch, who lived just north of Whoville, did not. The Grinch hated Christmas the whole Christmas season. Now, please don't ask why. No one quite knows the reason. It could be, perhaps, that his shoes were too tight. It could be his head wasn't screwed on just right. But I think that the most likely reason of all may have been that his heart was two sizes too small. But whatever the reason, his heart or his shoes, he stood there on Christmas Eve, hating the Who's, staring down from his cave with a sour, grinchy frown. Warm, lighted windows below in their tower, for he knew every who down in Whoville beneath was busy now, hanging a holly who wreath.
Trim up the tree with Christmas stuff, like bingo balls and hoo-hoo fluff. Trim up the town with goo-hoo gums and gizzle pinks and wands.
Trim every blessed window and trim every blessed door. Hang up hoo-hoo-hoo fix,
then run out and get some more.
Hang pantookas on the ceilings, pile pantoonas on the floor.
Trim every blessed needle on the blessed Christmas tree. Christmas comes tomorrow.
Trim you, trim me. Trim up your pets with buzz, oh buzz, and with her blues and buzz, oh buzz. Trim up your uncle and your aunt with yards of poop of plant. Trim every house in Whoville from the cellar to the roof. Hang up a mile of dafflers
and 3 miles of snappers too.
Hang dang-donglers on the bathtub, trim the occupant with floof.
To every home in Whoville and to every blessed who, Christmas comes tomorrow.
Trim me, trim you. Trim up the tree with Christmas stuff, like bingo balls and hoop-hoop-pup. Trim up the town with goo-hoo gums and beers, oh, things. And trim up the tree with fizzle pinks and bombs.
And they're hanging their stockings, he snarled the sneer.
Tomorrow is Christmas. It's practically here. Then he growled with his Grinch fingers, nervously rubbing. I must find some way to keep Christmas from coming. Or tomorrow, I know. All those who girls and boys will wake bright and early. They'll rush for their toys and then, oh, the noise, oh, the noise, 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 noise. There's one thing I hate. All the noise, 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 noise. And their shrieks, squeaks, and squeals racing round on their wheels. They'll dance with jing-tinglers tied onto their heels. They'll blow their flu-flubers, they'll bang their tartinkers. They'll blow their hoo-hoobers, they'll bang their garstinkers. They'll beat their trum-tookers, they'll slam their slu-slockers. They'll beat their blum-blookers, they'll whang their hoo-wonkers. And they'll play noisy games like Zuzita Kaze, a roller skate type of lacrosse and croquet. And then they'll make ear-splitting noises to looks on their great big electro-hoo-cardio schnooks. Then the hoos, young and old, will sit down to a feast. And they'll feast, and they'll feast. And they'll feast, 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 feast. They'll feast on hoo pudding and rare hoo roast beast. Raw roast beast is a feast I can't stand in the least. And then they'll do something I hate most of all. Every hoo down in Whoville, the tall and the small, will stand close together with Christmas bells ringing. They'll stand hand in hand, and those hoos will start singing. Grinch thought of this whole Christmas sing, the more the Grinch thought, I must stop this whole thing. Why, for 53 years I put up with it now. I must stop Christmas from coming. But how? Then he got an idea, an awful idea. The Grinch got a wonderful, awful idea. I know just what to do, the Grinch laughed in his throat. I'll make a quick Santa Claus hat to the goat. He chuckled and clucked. What a great Grinchy trick. With this coat and this hat, I'll look just like Saint Nick. All I need is a reindeer.
The Grinch looked around, but since reindeer are scarce, there was none to be found. Did that stop the Grinch?
Ha!
The Grinch simply said,
if I can't find a reindeer, I'll make one instead.
So he took his dog Max, and he took some black thread, and he tied a big horn on the top of his head. Then he loaded some bags and some old empty sacks on a ramshackle sleigh, and he whistled for Max. Then the Grinch said, "Get up!" And the sleigh started down toward the homes where the Whos lay a-snoozing their drown. Windows were dark. No one knew he was there. All the Whos were all dreaming sweet dreams without care. When he came to the first little house on the square.
"This is stop number one,"
the old Grinchy Claus hissed as he climbed to the roof, empty bags in his fist. Then he slid down the chimney, a rather tight pinch, but if Santa could do it then, so could the Grinch. He got stuck only once, for a minute or two. Then he stuck his head out of the fireplace flue where the little Who stockings hung all in a row.
"These stockings," he grinched, "are the first things to go."
Slithered and slunk with a smile most unpleasant around the whole room, and he took every present. Popguns, pamponas, pantookas and drums, checkerboards, bisselbinks, popcorn and plums, and he stuffed them in bags. Then the Grinch very nimbly stuffed all the bags one by one up the chimbley.
"You're a mean one, Mr. Grinch. You really are a heel. You're as cuddly as a cactus. You're as charming as an eel, Mr. Grinch. You're a bad banana with a greasy black peel." "You're a monster, Mr. Grinch. Your heart's an empty hole. Your brain is full of spiders. You've got garlic in your soul, Mr. Grinch. I wouldn't touch you with a 39 and a half foot pole. You're a vile one, Mr. Grinch. You have termites in your smile. You have all the tender sweetness of a seasick crocodile, Mr. Grinch. Given the choice between the two of you, I'd take the seasick crocodile."
Then he slunk to the icebox. He took the Who's feast. He took the Who pudding. He took the roast beast. He cleaned out the icebox as quick as a flash. Why, that Grinch even took the last can of Who hash. Then he stuffed all the food up the chimney with glee. "And now," grinned the Grinch, "I will stuff up the tree." As the Grinch took the tree, as he started to shove, he heard a small sound like the coo of a dove. He turned around fast and he saw a small Who, little Cindy Lou Who, who was no more than two. She stared at the Grinch and said, "Santa Claus, why? Why are you taking our Christmas tree? Why?" But you know, that old Grinch was so smart and so slick, he thought up a lie and he thought it up quick.
"Why, my sweet little tot," the fake Santa Claus lied, "there's a light on this tree that won't light on one side. So I'm taking it home to my workshop, my dear. I'll fix it up there, then I'll bring it back here."
And his fib fooled the child. Then he patted her head and he got her a drink and he sent her to bed. And when Cindy Lou Who was in bed with her cup, he crept
to the chimney and stuffed the tree up. Then he went up the chimney himself, the old liar, and the last thing he took was the log for their fire. On their walls he left nothing but hooks and some wire. And the one speck of food that he left in the house was a crumb that was even too small for a mouse. Then he did the same thing to the other whose houses, leaving crumbs much too small for the other whose mouses.
You're a foul one, Mr. Grinch. You're a nasty, wasty skunk. Your heart is full of unwashed socks. Your soul is full of gunk, Mr. Grinch. The three words that best describe you are as follows, and I quote, stink, stank, stunk. You're a rotter, Mr. Grinch. You're the king of sinful sots. Your heart's a dead tomato splotched with moldy purple spots, Mr. Grinch. Your soul is an appalling dump heap, overflowing with the most disgraceful assortment of deplorable rubbish imaginable, mangled up in tangled up knots. You nauseate me, Mr. Grinch, with a nauseous super nos. You're a crooked jerky jockey, and you drive a crooked hoss, Mr. Grinch. You're a three-decker sauerkraut and toadstool sandwich with arsenic sauce.
It was a quarter of dawn, all the who's still abed, all the who's still a snooze, when he packed up his sled. Packed it up with their presents, their ribbons, their wrappings, their snoof and their fuzzles, their tringlers and trappings. 10,000 feet up, up the side of Mount Crumpet, he rode with his load to the tip-top to dump it. The Who's, he was grinchily humming. They're finding out now that no Christmas is coming. They're just waking up. I know just what they'll do. Their mouths will hang open a minute or two. Then the Who's down in Whoville will all cry, boo-hoo. That's a noise, grinned the Grinch, that I simply must hear.
He paused, and the Grinch put a hand to his ear. And he did hear a sound rising over the snow. It started in low. Then it started to grow. This sound wasn't sad. Why, this sound sounded glad. Every who down in Whoville, the tall and the small, was singing. Without any presents at all. He hadn't stopped Christmas from coming. It came. Somehow or other, it came just the same. And the Grinch with his Grinch feet, ice cold in the snow, stood puzzling and puzzling.
How could it be so? It came without ribbons. It came without tags. It came without packages, boxes, or bags.
He puzzled and puzzled till his puzzler was sore. Then the Grinch thought of something he hadn't before.
Maybe Christmas, he thought, doesn't come from a store. Maybe Christmas, perhaps, means a little bit more.
And what happened then? Well, in Whoville, they say, that the Grinch's small heart grew 3 sizes that day.
And then the true meaning of Christmas came through, and the Grinch found the strength of 10 Grinches, plus 2. And now that his heart didn't feel quite so tight, he whizzed with his load through the bright morning light. With a smile in his soul, he descended Mount Crumpet, cheerily blowing ho, ho on his trumpet. He rode into Whoville, he brought back their toys, he brought back their floof to the Who girls and boys. He brought back their snoop and their tringlers and fuzzles, brought back their pantookas, their dafflers and wuzzles. He brought everything back, all the food for the feast. And he himself, the Grinch, carved the roast beast. Welcome, Christmas. Bring your cheer. Cheer to all who's far and near. Christmas Day is in our grasp, so long as we have hands to clasp. Christmas Day will always be just as long as we have breathed. Welcome, Christmas, while we stand heart to heart and hand in hand.
Welcome, Christmas, the Hoorahs. Welcome, Christmas, the Hoorahs. Welcome, Christmas, while we stand heart to heart and hand in hand. Wahoo for it, the Hoorahs. Welcome, welcome, Christmas, Christmas Day.
Have a good evening and come back again next week. This has been Bill Holwick from West Texas for Broken Sea Audio Productions. www.brokensea.com. Good evening. Good evening. The music for tonight's episode was composed by Brian of Seraphic Panoply and Stevie Farnaby. Douglas and Bela of Howlow brought their tunes to tonight's episode, too.